FM on the Internet. We cover all things computing, and our viewpoint is always, what's in the best interest of the consumer community?
Everyone, I'm Gary Null, and today we're going to find out from the University of Washington why we're not sleeping as soundly as historically we did, and about 15 other good original scientific reports. Then I'm going to share something today that I consider extremely significant, and it just came to me about 4 or 5 days ago. And it came to me in a way that I finally put together the pieces of how wrong our entire thinking on healthcare is in this country. And I've come up with a lot of different insights over the years. Hopefully people have appreciated some of these. But this is going to manifest, I believe, in a whole new movement. So they thought they buried us with criticisms and false accusations of quackery and pseudoscientific. Well, what they didn't realize, that they didn't bury us because we were a million seeds and now we're germinating. So this is going to be important. You won't want to miss that. I'm also going to address, to the degree I can, your questions and comments on our talkback line. I don't know how much more time I'll have after that, but let's get started. So right now we're blaming smartphones and those constant alerts and the deluge of media for our society's sleep deprivation. But according to the University of Washington, the root cause of why we get less sleep now than our ancestors did could come down to a much simpler reason: artificial light. New research comparing traditional hunter-gatherer living conditions to a more modern setting shows that access to artificial light and electricity has shortened the amount of sleep humans get each night. This was published in the Journal of Biological Rhythms, and it's the first study to document this relationship in the field. So the researcher is saying that everything that they are looking at keeps coming back to this artificial manipulation of light. And that's one of the reasons that whenever I travel, even when I'm in New York in my apartment, I have this little iPad. I put on my, not an iPhone, an iPad, a little soft cotton pad that I put over my eyes so it blocks out all light. I put earplugs in, blocks out all sound, and that way I can get some sleep. But people get used to noises of all types and lights everywhere. So get rid of the light, get rid of the sound, don't eat within 3 hours going to bed, and try to do something calming. One of the most calming things I have found is to take about 10 minutes of just listening to rain on a tin roof. It absolutely will just mellow you out. And you can get apps for all kinds of rain and nature sounds. It helps. Also, a new study from the University of Valencia, which is in Spain, for those of you who like to drink your beer, it's increasing your exposure to mycotoxins, M-Y-C-O, toxins. Researchers from the University of Valencia have analyzed the mycotoxins produced by certain microscopic fungi in the beer and even in some dried fruits like figs and raisins. And they're confirming that these products meet food regulations, but only for beer drinkers is there a problem, because they could be contributing to this community of the daily intake of these mycotoxins. Now, mycotoxins are toxic metabolites produced by fungi that contaminate fruits and cereals and derivative products. And we've known this for a long time. This is not anything new. And the results of this study published in the journal Food Chemistry confirms that the average consumer's exposure to these toxins is low, which is good, unless you're a big beer drinker. And a lot of people are. In fact, the whole new fad today is designer beers. In fact, there's one near where I live in New York, and I'd heard about it. So I went across the street, and it was 11 o'clock at night, and I'd just gotten out of a movie theater, and I just wanted to see how many people were there, because almost all the other restaurants on Broadway are closed by 11 o'clock. We forget that, yes, it's New York City, but it's not the downtown New York that comes alive at night. This is a family neighborhood, and therefore people generally are in bed or in their apartments at that time. This place was packed. Absolutely every seat was taken. People were standing around the walls. And I looked at the menu, and a boar's head sandwich was $65. And the beers started at least the ones I saw, were $50 to $60 a beer. And then I walked around, and I was curious, how many beers are people having? And they had the empty bottles on their tables, and 4 to 5 per person. First, I thought, who in the world could afford to go out and just have some beers and spend $400? And secondly, and who knows how many nights they do that, how would they really know the difference between one beer and another? Because most alcohol of a different of a similar type, like vodkas, tastes the same, gins taste the same, bourbon, they all like to make themselves think that we're really special. You know, we ferment ours for an extra 8 years. Who cares? It's a stupid thing to do. It burns your throat, burns your mouth, burns your stomach, causes esophageal cancer, causes stomach cancer, causes gross inflammation in your intestines, kills 1 million brain cells, heart cells, and kidney cells. So the fact that you have a famous actress showing you why it's so cool to have that, you know, that alcohol, it's really stupid. Anyhow, so when you're drinking a lot of beer, you're taking in mycoplasma or mycotoxins, and that's not good. Also, according to the British Medical Journal, article also in the Journal of Clinical Pathology, doctors often misdiagnose zinc deficiency, simple zinc deficiency, and are even unaware of the impact of excess zinc. Too much zinc, taken in the form of any supplement, can disrupt copper uptake and leading to neurological problems like anemia. But zinc is also very essential for so many things in our body, generally around 20 milligrams. And yet we're not paying attention. A lot of people don't take any zinc at all, and some people take too much. So if you end up with some other conditions, make sure that it's not due to taking zinc or overtaking zinc. For those of you who are starting to shift over to a Mediterranean diet, good for you. Madrid University in Spain has shown that olive oil in the Mediterranean diet boosts your bone health. Now, this is particularly true for men and women who are postmenopausal or andropausal. You're just not getting enough minerals and the right combination of minerals to feed into the bone so the bone can become strong. And bone health is not something that most people think about until it becomes an issue, which is usually later in life. And while men and women can both suffer from weakening of the bones, it's a particular issue for women, especially after they hit menopause. And that's because of the drop in estrogen levels that menopause brings with it, a drop which can lead to a loss of calcium from the bones. And it's this loss of calcium that leads to brittle bones. And these brittle bones can put women at risk of serious fractures, including fractures of the hip, which can lead to a permanent loss of mobility, internal infections. People die from this. However, one of the things I've noticed on my many trips to the Mediterranean and interviewing hundreds of people about their diet and lifestyle and their customs and their cultures is that you rarely see women in the Mediterranean areas. In fact, I remember in Italy and in Spain, I couldn't find a single person I interviewed that said that they had osteoporosis. That is surprising. But then again, they drink a lot of olive oil over there. In fact, it's very common when you go into someone's home, even into restaurants, there's a little bowl in the middle of the table, might be a plate, and it's filled with different types of olive oil, which are much darker than what you see in the United States, have a stronger taste. And they will sop up some homemade bread, and that's what they have as part of their appetizer before the main meal. We're not taking in what they do. Women in the Mediterranean countries typically consume lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, lots of olive oil and olives, typically up to 4 tablespoons of olive oil a day. So olive oil is extremely rich in nutrients, which is, I'm talking about the organic, virgin, extra, first press olive oil. So just take your olive oil and have stronger bone health. From Guangdong University in China, when you combine curcumin with another nutrient, you enhance the growth inhibition of androgen-dependent prostate cancer cells. In lay language, if you want to have a healthier prostate, well, first, if you don't want prostate conditions, then give up on sugar, alcohol, and animal proteins. Right there, you're going to be reducing by probably 80% your opportunity for that. Then get rid of the pot belly. You don't need it, and it's going to kill you. It literally can kill you. It is a predictive condition for heart disease, a pot belly. It's not just the amount of fat you have on your body. It's where it's located on the body. And hip fat and belly fat are the most dangerous types of fat. So work out, get rid of the fat, stay on that diet, and then also make sure that each day you're getting maybe, I would say, 1,000 milligrams of curcumin. Cure, C-U-R, cumin, C-U-M-I-N. That can be a big thing. And one of the most single important things you can do to live a longer life and a healthier life, according to the University of Southern California, is have a diet that mimics fasting. So you can also lose that abdominal fat. You get smarter, and you live longer. That's what the University of Southern California has found from the effects of modified fasting. What do I mean by modified fasting? They can help your brain and stem cells and several organs. They can, these progenitors and stem cells can literally reverse the aging of your organs. And this was published in Cell Metabolism, a highly respected journal. Let's just say that I start my day with a smoothie, or what some of my friends call Gary's mud, because it looks like mud. It looks like that because of all the chlorophyll that's in there. But it's a whole combination of different powders and some fruits, some nuts or nut butters, some plant-based protein, and some coconut oil and essential fatty acids. In any case, I liquefy that with some form of liquid, like maybe coconut milk. And then I drink that glass then, and then later another glass, later another glass. Now that's modified fasting. One meal a day is all I eat, but then I graze with small amounts of food. Like yesterday afternoon, I just took a fresh organic avocado, sliced it in half, I soaked it in lemon juice off some lemon trees, and then I put in some oregano leaves and fresh, and then I took some sweet onion, cut a thick slice of sweet onion, and a thick slice of fresh beefsteak organic tomato. And that's it. Oh, yeah, and some mustard. Put some mustard on it. So it was a sandwich without bread. It was maybe 1.5 inches thick. And that, talk about a power snack, that's enough to keep your blood sugar stable It's delicious tasting. Has a nice mouthfeel. Good fiber in it. Lots of nutrients. Full spectrum of all the nutrients, especially the good fats from avocado and the good lycopene mixture from tomatoes and the good anti-cancer agents from mustard, which are part of the cruciferous family. And then the sulfur from the onion, which grabs onto bacteria and viruses and kills them. And a simple little snack. Low in calories, high in nutrient density. So when you eat like that, you're not overwhelming the digestive system. So it kind of mimics a fast. So I'm not talking about just fasting on water. I'm talking about lowering the caloric intake into your body. Also from Zurich Institute for Molecular Health Sciences, fructose, that really, really bad sugar, it creates a vicious cycle. And that cycle is destructive to your cardiovascular system. It can lead to a heart failure. Yeah, your liver and your kidneys. It's terrible for everything in your body. It should never be used. It's no better than a poison. And I'll give you just one aspect. There's a new paper by Kreck and his team, Peter Mertschink, and they describe how more troubling side effects of fructose. The researchers discovered a previously unknown molecular mechanism that points to fructose as a key driver of uncontrolled growth of the heart muscle, a condition that can lead to fatal heart failure. And that was published in the National Enquirer? No. The most respected scientific publication in the world, Nature. So would you think that somehow, let's see, who can I name here? Oh, I know, Sharon Rockefeller, sitting on the board of the PBS, got that in your pocket station down in Washington, D.C., and friends with the people at the Sugar Institute. And they're the ones who blocked me from being on any more PBS Washington when she took offense to me showing how much regular sucrose a person eats in a day. David Slater, my attorney at the time, poured out that morning in front of me on a gram scale, 40 teaspoons of sugar. We were both there and measured it, sealed this bag. And then in the show, I opened it up and poured that out and saying, this is how much sugar that's hidden in the diet you're not seeing, like 12 teaspoons in a cola. I didn't know that she was the head of the local board, but boy, the show was a great success, by the way. And the program director was a nice guy. I'd met him when he was in Detroit on PBS. He said, Gary, this is not in prime time, and you beat every single show in our entire drive, and you're not even in prime time. He said, I'm going to play this 8 more times this week. Okay. And then a half hour later, he comes over, and he's looking very sad. I said, what's wrong? He said, well, I just got a call from Sharon Rockefeller, and she had gotten a call from the sugar people running some sugar institute, and they say, you can't say that. That's not true. And she says, you never have him back on. Don't play the show again. And he said, so, the people love you, but the people in power don't. So I'm sorry, I can't have you back. He said, this is a shameful day for me. I says, look, don't blame yourself. You're the good guy. But Sharon Rockefeller is not the good person. She's of the Rockefellers. Her husband from my state, and he's an embarrassment, is Jay Rockefeller. Jay, you ever want to debate me, you clown? Come on my show. Don't send your wife to work behind the scenes. You're cowards. And you're in Congress. Oh, stupid me. That's where cowards belong, isn't it? Work behind the scenes. Yeah, try pulling that number where the public can hear both sides of debate on sugar. In fact, you know what I'm going to do? Jesse, go into our archives and get the letter that I wrote to Sharon Rockefeller. I wrote to her husband, and I wrote to every member, the crepid, decrepit, God, are they terrible, members of the National PBS Board. What a group of punks. I wrote him a letter. My lawyer wrote him a letter. We gave him a whole article on the scientific references of what was bad about sugar. But telling the truth about sugar? No, you can't do that. And why? She was on the board of Pepsi-Cola. Let's make a connection. Fructose, colas. fructose disease, fructose death. You're on a board, you're paid, you're powerful, you're a policymaker. You're using your celebrity status, and then you try to block the health consequences of what you're doing. That's something I'll never forget, but I want the people that really count, not you punks in Washington, and the entire city has been punked. It's not a swamp. In swamps, you have snakes and you have alligators. They're not our enemy. They're part of the natural equation. They live where they can survive. We're not supposed to go in their swamp and live there. No, Washington, D.C. is supposed not to be a swamp. It's supposed to be the city on the hill, filled with the virtues of men and women whose only motivation is to go there to serve the constituents and make it a better and safer world. Cleaner air, cleaner water, cleaner food. That's what it's supposed to be. My God, what they've become and what they are, including Rachel Maddow and the people that support them. I'm going to share something about Rachel Maddow and her attack against Julian Assange in a little bit and show you why she's wrong on every single point she made, but that's not unusual and that's not uncommon. In any case, so here's Nature magazine saying, yeah. So when a person has high blood pressure, the heart has to grow as it is needed to pump the blood through the circulatory system. Now, these growing heart muscle cells require a considerable amount of oxygen. However, since not enough oxygen is available to adequately supply the increased growth, the cells switch to an alternative energy supply. Instead of drawing energy from fatty acids, they rely more on an anaerobic process called glycolysis, literally the splitting of sugars. If the heart muscle cells can access fructose in addition to glucose, that can set off a fatal chain reaction. So, that's why you should stay away from all fructose and all fructose, processed fructose. When you eat an apple, you're getting some fructose, not the same. So, normal fruit consumption is safe. Processed fructose is not. Also, from the University of Tasmania, they found that seaweed extract can hold promise for irritable bowel syndrome. Wait, didn't I just see an ad last night on television? Irritable bowel, we have this pill. Oh, the side effects are death. No, there's no side effects here because it's from a natural source. It's an extract of the fucoidins, which provide promise for treating a type of inflammatory bowel disease known as ulcerative colitis. And that was published in PLOS One. So let's see. We can believe the TV, and that means we have to trust the advertising and executive staff that accepts advertising, and hopefully at some level qualifies it, but they never do on anything. And then we are given the idea that let's watch these people doing something fun when they're talking about the side effects. You ever notice that? Every commercial, when it finally gets to the place where you're probably going to drop dead and your children are going to be born blind, you know, and you'll never have another erection if you take our headache remedy, and it's only $400,000 a year. That seems completely normal. But taking something that is natural and non-toxic, like a seaweed extract, there's something kind of, what, unusual and creepy. Why? I don't want to take fructose. I don't want to take this seaweed extract. I'd rather trust what I see on television. Okay. I'm just telling you, there's a natural, non-toxic way to deal with this. Now, from University of Washington comes a new study that any added sugar is bad sugar. And any source of excess sugar contributes to obesity and diabetes, and high fructose corn syrup in this study is the worst of all. Two studies from two different universities finding how bad sugar is, excess calories, and it's toxic. That's the latest in health and healing. We're 25 minutes into our program. We're going to take a very brief break and come back, because I've got something to share with you. So if you are into using any form of alternative healing, that would mean anything such as holistic dentistry, Ayurvedic naturopathic, alternative and complementary medicine, holistic nursing, holistic nutrition or wellness counseling, meditation and yoga, body-mind therapies. You'll want to pay attention because I have an answer and it's been right in front of us, but it took me all these decades to figure it out. I figured it out. I'm going to share it with you now. I'd like to welcome all of you. Thank you, Jesse. Jesse runs the Progressive Radio Network and working there in the studio, brand new state-of-the-art studio, by the way, with our engineers. And he's just now posting the definitive article on sugar, and I wrote it. Deadly at Any Dose, Sugar and the Corruption of Science, Part 1. There were three parts to it. And then he is now going to find the legal letters where we called out Sharon Rockefeller, called out the entire board of the PBS, called out the Sugar Institute. I challenged the Sugar Institute, come on my program and debate me. Bring your scientists. Let's make it even. 1,000 of you guys, sugar scientists, and me. That's even, because I haven't been paid to tell anyone anything. You have. And therefore, that's compromised. Anyhow, I'm calling out the Sugar Institute again. So here we are, and we're broadcast all over. Anyone working for Sharon Rockefeller, including her husband, Jay Rockefeller, you're invited on my program to debate me. I will give you the respect I do every single person that comes on this air. Whatever you're going to say, you will not be interrupted. And then I will have an opportunity to deconstruct your points of view. You have that invitation. I believe in debate. I do not believe in working behind the scenes as the people in Washington, D.C. do, all of them, by powering in on who you know will support your position because it's economically, ideologically, or financially important to them to support you. Because we just don't have any of the people who represent we the people. So that is posted now. Read it. But here's something altogether different. About a decade ago, my late close friend and colleague of over 45 years, Dr. Martin Feldman, and I were invited to be keynote speakers at a very important and prestigious medical conference that was dealing with anti-aging and in Chicago. The hall was packed with several thousand clinicians and physicians, medical professors, scientific researchers, and doctors of conventional medicine who were using some non-conventional disciplines, who were interested in the latest anti-aging research. So Marty and I presented a paper based upon a year-long clinical study we had conducted, and following the presentation, a professor, an MD, PhD, and professor at a California medical school asked me, would I meet with her and a few other people privately in a separate conference room? I said, sure. So about an hour later, Marty and I go over there, and I was only anticipating a handful of doctors. Therefore, I was taken aback to see hundreds. The room was packed. These were MDs and PhDs. They had all crammed into this conference room. And we spent hours together, and the physicians and professors were mostly board certified. They held in common inclusion of non-toxic, non-drug therapies in their protocols to treat their patients. The professor who invited me had published over 180 articles in the peer-reviewed literature, but she was unable to get her own clinical research using alternative medical therapies published. This was despite the fact that there is already hundreds of thousands of studies and prints supporting the scientific basis, the legitimacy, the gold standard of what she in science of what is considered acceptable. And she and thousands of other physicians around the United States are using it. What I learned from listening to these doctors' complaints is that they feared speaking out publicly about their successes. They worried that they would be attacked and could face interrogation from state medical boards for breaking rank with the status quo. One professor from the University of Chicago's medical school stated that he and his colleagues felt as if they were in the closet. They couldn't come out. However, what surprised me was their integrity and credentials and knowledge about the causes of disease. They really had a grounding in that and non-toxic natural therapies that could reverse them, something as simple as a plant-based diet. The California professor remarked that if she were to make public, even in the local media, even discussing something as simple as having some patients with diseases that mainstream medicine would not have been able to reverse, but she did, that would have been it. Her career would have been over. And her regime would not have been accepted. She used some homeopathy, she used plant-based diets, she used supplementation. But the university, she said, would attack her, and she could lose and would lose the funding as well as her license and her reputation. My advice for these doctors, because I'd already gone through this with New York and New Jersey doctors who have been universally, without exception, all attacked. Harold Rosenberg and Robert Atkins, Robert Giller, they had all been attacked, even though they were not hurting their patients. Most of them were doing, you know, their own unique holistic medical approaches, and they had just taken a beating. Carl Humiston had lost his license. He was a Harvard guy, and he was actually one of the heads of the local county medical society. But once he got out, he was using these therapies. They went after him. So I said to the group, why don't you pull together, pull your resources, take 1%, that's just one penny out of every dollar, and contribute it to a foundation that will hire on staff a common cause lawyer that will fight for everyone's benefit. So if you're attacked, if any one of you are attacked, then you all support that person being attacked, and you will have some funds in the foundation specifically earmarked for doing original research, collecting all the scientific data so that if you are attacked, you can have someone go in and say, look at all the scientific studies published on PubMed that support that what we are doing is completely legitimate. And I said, that's the only way you're going to win, or at least draw attention to your crisis. They all said that it was too risky. Therefore, nothing happened, and alternative medicine's acceptance in the mainstream continued to worsen. The consequence has been that tens of thousands of trained, highly qualified, and idealistic practitioners have been forced to suffer and remain silent and practice quietly. The irony is that with tens of millions of patients turning towards non-conventional medicine, and with this trend increasing rapidly as conventional drug interventions repeatedly fail, these are the real heroes who are being isolated and shunned from the mainstream. And yet they have the support of the scientific literature to back their health claims, as well as countless patient testimonials. It cannot be emphasized enough that a significant proportion of modern medicine is a failure, but nevertheless, mythologized as a success. In the United States, a National Institutes of Health survey recorded that 2.1%, representing over 6.5 million Americans, use homeopathy. We also found that about 3,000 board-certified American physicians incorporating homeopathy into their clinical practice. 27 million people turn to chiropractic. Globally, 80% of the world's population use traditional botanical medical therapies. There are no accurate estimates for traditional Chinese medicine and Indian Ayurvedic users in the United States. However, there are over 6,000 practicing naturopaths, board-certified physicians, and more than 27,000 licensed acupuncturists. After we add other holistic therapies such as meditative behavior modification, hypnosis, energy medicine, various mind-body therapies, therapeutic massage, etc., we find a large percentage of Americans resorting to some form of alternative therapy, whether or not they follow allopathic protocols as well. Unfortunately, the real pioneers in this healing arts field have no voice, and more often than not, they are ridiculed and damned. The message is clear. Stay in your little corner, remain silent, and don't stir the pot. Draw no attention to you or your therapies. During the course of my career, I've spoken with thousands of physicians who incorporate some form of alternative medicine into their clinical practice. It is fair to say many are terrified of the industrial medical complex and its henchmen in the government, agencies, and media. With very rare exceptions, such as the groundbreaking work of Dr. Dean Ornish, we will read in medical journals the profiles of the men and women who are pioneering safer and more effective ways to prevent and reverse disease outside of the dominant medical matrix. How about never? You just never find an article in the Journal of the American Medical Association or the Lancet saying, a healthy plant-based diet done by Dr. such and such at this clinic was able to work with 3,000 people over a five-year period and was able to statistically change the outcome of multiple diseases. And yet there will be articles written that support plant-based diets, just not the individuals. You see, the only reason Dr. Dean Ornish, in my opinion, is working today is because he was the first cardiologist to prove that with, and I was there, I was the only one filming it at the time, downtown in Manhattan. I filmed him and I filmed his patients. With just exercise and stress management and a plant-based diet, they were able to reverse blocked arteries, congestive heart failure. And he published this New England Journal of Medicine in The Lancet. He did it again and again published it. Nothing happened. But hold on, we're told that if you create a better way of doing something that is safer and more efficacious, that people will turn in that direction. No one turned in that direction. Individual physicians here and there did, but medicine did not. Now, we have another part to that, and that is the simple reason why a board-certified physician would jump ship and turn to these alternative therapies to give his patients is because they work. And they have experienced firsthand the trail of severe complications and injuries and deaths caused by conventional medicine. Even the American Medical Association Journal noted that iatrogenic or medically induced death is the third leading cause of death in the United States after cardiovascular disease and cancer. A very conservative figure places the number at approximately 300,000 deaths annually. Our own analysis suggests drug complications and medical error is actually the first cause of death. But even if we use the lowest, most conservative number, and we multiply this figure over the course of the previous 10 years, we're looking at 3 million Americans who died at the hands of modern medicine. 3 million. What do you think would happen if a drug killed 3 million people, or a genetically modified apple killed 3 million people? What if anything killed 3 million people? What if in all of our wars, in our history, we've never had 3 million deaths? What would happen? That would be genocide to kill 3 million people. Yet not a single meeting, no changes, no question of the paradigm, no asking those who profited to give back their profits, no sense of repenting. Nothing. They got away with it. They got away with genocide. So those who are responsible for this medical genocide are never, ever held accountable, nor is medicine, nor is the pharmaceutical industry. In fact, they are rewarded. This presents a double standard because these are the same leaders of the modern medical regime who most viciously attack safer natural protocols. They make every effort to coordinate an attack and contain alternative medicine, which they perceive as a threat to their control over the nation's health care. We have discovered a term that describes this phenomena, and it describes it accurately. So here is my new term, medical apartheid. What do I mean? Many of the most innovative health practitioners and those speaking out about the risks of conventional medicine and proven benefits of alternatives find themselves stuck in a medical gulag. Notable examples include Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Deepak Chopra, Larry Dawsey, Andrew Weil, David Perlmutter, and hundreds more. The guards over this apartheid encampment are the CDC, the leading medical associations, the mainstream media, radicalized skeptic organizations espousing scientific materialism, such as the Center for Inquiry, social media platforms like Wikipedia, and especially Wikipedia, and of course the pharmaceutical companies that bank their efforts. One is no less responsible than the other. They work in unison for the sole purpose of advancing the pipelines of the drug makers while roping off the opposition. Consequently, the apartheid regime acts as a court that both charges and convicts without a jury. It plays the role of judge and executioner, and this apartheid is now being demonstrated everywhere in our society. Just one simple example is the career of Dr. Linus Pauling, one of the most prolific medical researchers in American history. Pauling had a distinguished career at Caltech University for over three decades. He published an astounding 1,200 scientific papers and books and was the rare recipient of not one, but two separate Nobel Prizes. Yet despite his spectacular career, it was his discovery that large doses of vitamin C could prevent and reduce the severity of colds and flu infections that turned him into a pariah within the medical establishment. His later discovery that mega doses of vitamin C could be used to treat terminal cancer further labeled him as a dangerous heretic. During a private conversation with Dr. Pauling, he shared with me his personal disappointment with the conventional medical community and predicted that in the future his entire career would be reduced to having been an advocate of pseudoscience. Indeed, his prophecy was fulfilled. Wikipedia describes orthomolecular medicine, of which he was one of the founders, along with a couple other individuals that I knew, Dr. Abram Hoffer among them, as a modality of alternative medicine founded by Dr. Pauling, which is based upon maintaining optimal health and nutritional supplementation is, quote, food, fatism, and quackery, end quote. That's surprising, because when I was speaking with Dr. Hoffer, in fact, when I brought Dr. Hoffer and Dr. Pauling both to New York with eight other scientists from around the United States for a conference, a seven-day conference, which over 1,500 of you attended, they discussed all the different things we were finding about how to help people with schizophrenia using niacin and other supplements. Did they ever have a conversation with either of these two gentlemen? The answer would be no. Did they read their papers? No. Now, I published in the Journal of Orthomolecular Medicine, and it's a difficult journal to get accepted into. It was based upon being able to reverse different mental conditions of people who had been in therapy and on medications for a long period of time to where they were completely drug-free and happy. Would any of the skeptics like to show us that they could duplicate that or find any other area of medicine that could show that they have done the same? The answer is no. So despite tens of thousands of peer-reviewed studies showing a wide range of health benefits for hundreds of different nutrients, Wikipedia only presents several dismal and poor-quality studies that claim the opposite. Dr. Pauling's case is a lesson to better understand why thousands of medical doctors and followers of non-conventional protocols with far less talent than Pauling are fearful that their work to heal patients may actually destroy their careers and reputations. And this identifies a tactic of the medical apartheid, meaning frame alternative medical practitioners and its advocates as enemies of public health and detain them in a prison of anxiety so they are fearful to reach out beyond the barbed wires of their gulag. And their gulag is Wikipedia. Definitions for apartheid vary just slightly. However, what they all have in common is that apartheid is a form of discrimination sanctioned by the law of the state. Apartheid's ultimate goal is to segregate a race, ethnicity, a belief system, or group in order to exclude them from the state privileges awarded to those to whom a regime holds in favor. The victims of apartheid find themselves entrapped in an open-air detention center. Although apartheid conjures images of Afrikaners, discrimination against minorities in South Africa, the Australian government's treatment, which was genocide of the Aboriginal peoples, the State of Israel's vicious repression and apartheid against Palestinians, and the southern states of the United States during the days of segregation, apartheid is an appropriate term to describe ideological repression, discrimination, and segregation waged against the followers of alternative points of view. The dominant medical paradigm's unceasing offensive against all forms of natural and alternative medicine has been with us for over a century. This assault is being undertaken by a wide network of players in the pharmaceutical industrial complex, including the federal health agencies, bought-off politicians, which are most, universities, most, professional medical associations, all of them, and journals, virtually all of them. The mainstream media, well, that's a no-brainer, and the Silicon Valley billionaires and their firms like Wikipedia. That's formidable. What the medical establishment shares with repressive racist governments is a vision to go beyond the boundaries of social and civil rights in order to establish its authority and control over its targeted victims. In effect, America's medical apartheid against non-conventional medical practice is nothing less than institutionalized prejudice. In effect, the non-conventional natural medical disciplines are being cordoned off into indentured serfdom. One feature of apartheid is that it permits the other to exist in isolation only. In South Africa, apartheid was a rule of law that enabled Afrikaners and South African blacks to develop independently under segregated conditions. The ruling Afrikaner government was fully aware it could not kill all minority groups, though they wanted to, and at different times tried, certainly their leaders, who they couldn't kill, they imprisoned, including Nelson Mandela. Therefore, a repressive system was created to sequester black communities. Likewise, the conventional medical establishment is making every effort to quarantine alternative medical systems. More important are the efforts to smother the success of its practitioners and the enormous body of peer-reviewed scientific literature indicating that these non-drug-based therapies are more effective and safe than the pharmaceutical model. One of the most nefarious federal laws in the books that perpetuates our nation's medical apartheid is to forbid any health claims to be associated with foods, vitamins, supplements, and medicinal herbs that are not gone through the FDA's regulatory hurdles for drugs approved and licensing. During the 2009 fake, completely fraudulent H1N1 epidemic, which it wasn't, the FDA harassed and threatened Dr. Andrew Weil for his claims that the popular Asian herb astragalus could prevent and treat swine flu infection. The warning came despite the enormous body of scientific literature in the National Institutes of Health's database of peer-reviewed medical literature showing that, indeed, it was true the plant astragalus possessed powerful antibacterial and antiviral properties. We reached out to Dr. Weil to come to support his claims, But he acquiesced and stopped and chose not to. The FDA has also led SWAT raids against the walnut and cherry industry for advertising their fruit might be anti-inflammatory, which it is. The sole reason for this unwarranted harassment was because astragalus and walnuts and cherries are not licensed medications. Few are aware that the FDA employs an army of armed goons eager to invade dairy farms providing raw milk to their communities. As ridiculous, as an asinine, as these examples might appear, it is regrettably the law of the land. And the pharmaceutical industry wrote those laws and told those moron toads in Congress, this is what you're going to vote for, and they go, okay. These are the abettors at the highest levels of the CDC, the FDA, and Health and Human Services. They're determined to maintain this apparatus of surveillance, repression, and persecution. Another characteristic of American medical apartheid is our healthcare system's differential attitude towards basic human rights and its regressive policies that sustain medical discrimination. America's healthcare now ranks at the dead last bottom level of all developed nations. You can't place your bets on the stock market for a potential boom in chiropractic traditional Chinese medicine or the discovery of a new effective natural treatment. There's no one who can patent it, hence they can't profit from it. So the delivery of medical services solely within a private insurance-based dynasty intentionally refuses to cover most of preventative and alternative medical practices. Wouldn't it just make sense, everyone? Just stop and wrap your head around this. With the insurance company making over $1 trillion a year, wouldn't it make sense that they would support preventing a disease so they wouldn't have to pay for it being treated later? But that's not how it works. By excluding holistic medicine from insurance coverage, patients are forced to pay out of pocket if they wish to follow a natural and less risky course of treatment. Imagine if the U.S. were more like Switzerland, which universally covers most alternative forms of treatment, including homeopathy. Article 25 of the United Universal Declaration states, quote, everyone has the right to be to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, end quote. However, in a medical apartheid regime, the ruling establishment controls the legislature and the federal health agencies that determine what is accepted medical practice. If health and wellness are basic human rights, then this apartheid perverts the very definition of health within its wrapped parameters that exclude other definitions and the more scientific means to restore wellness. Consequently, another characteristic of an apartheid is structural discrimination. Discrimination against alternative medicine filters down into additional laws limiting the public freedom of choice and access to vital health information. Examples are the recent flurry of laws being passed in a growing number of states that mandate vaccination in efforts to restrict all nutritional counseling, including adverse advice concerning vitamins and supplements, to certified dietitians who follow only the system's accepted guidelines. Any naturopath, alternative nutritionist, food counselor who follows a different medical model is presumed to be inferior. Therefore, the apartheid makes every effort to hamper the influence of their practices, and this is one reason why medical apartheid is analogous to other forms of institutional racism. South Africa's apartheid acknowledged completely the potential political strength of the non-Afrikaner communities. It fully realized its capacity to upset the status quo of white rule. Therefore, an apartheid will recognize the existence of the other while simultaneously denying and undermining its value to the nation or larger community. Similarly, the medical apartheid promulgates a culture of cognitive dissidence within the medical community while acknowledging that there is a vast, huge, overwhelming body of scientific literature published in the government's own database to prove alternative therapies' efficacy and safety. At the very same time, it is determined never to advocate on behalf of these therapies and attack those who use them. Preference is given to drugs over safety and cost savings and prevention. And finally, we should note the important role the powers of private lobbying play to enforce laws and turn marginalize and limit the practice of non-conventional medicine. Lobbying favors our medical regime, which has become increasingly defined by financial incentives rather than restoring the health of ill patients. by encircling alternative health systems with bad press. Oh, you're never going to be disappointed if you want to see someone slam who's doing the good things with natural healing. Just read the New York Times or Washington Post. These are the lapdogs of orthodoxy. Shame on these journalists. And thank God there are more Chris Hedges who would rather quit and walk away than be compromised on principle. And then you have the vitriol and abuse on social media, such as Wikipedia and Facebook, with regressive laws limiting public access to invaluable treatments and by erecting prejudice obstacles to bar non-conventional medical achievements from entering professional medical journals and conferences and medical schools. Why was it that the conferences I've attended, all with outstanding scientists by the thousands all over the country, why are they never discussed in any media whatsoever, including mainstream media? But not a word, as if it didn't happen. But it did happen. And their patients by the millions benefited. Rather, similar to Israel's strategic fragmentation of the Palestinian people, the dominant establishment oppresses its presumed competition by means of distinct laws, rigid policies, coordinated harassment, and inequitable practices. And finally, once ensnarled in the apartheid detention zone, there is no recourse unless a physician renounces his or her life's work, repents to the medical authorities, and publicly voices hostility against the very treatments used successfully to treat patients. This is the case of several prominent alternative health practitioners who converted to skepticism, as former chiropractic Samuel Hahnemann, and more notably, a man named Ernst, a former professor of complementary medicine at the University of Exeter in the United Kingdom, who was forced to retire early following conflicts with Prince Charles. The prince advocated for greater inclusion of alternative medicine in the British healthcare system as a safe, effective, and cost-saving strategy to prevent disease. Both of these other two are now regarded as heroes by skeptics, given awards by skeptics, and are often referenced as a proof of concept that non-conventional medicine simply doesn't work. It's dangerous and therefore should be regarded as quackery. Wikipedia is the principal holder of the virtual keys to the Internet's medical apartheid. Wikipedia's co-founder Jimmy Wales and his minions of militant skeptics serve as the final arbiters as to whether a physician will be awarded a laurel wreath or be condemned with professional death sentence. Our investigations during the past year have convinced us that there is no reason whatsoever to question that Wikipedia's skeptic editors have direct or indirect lines of collusion with the apartheid drug industry and enablers in government, universities, and professional associations. Their critical role in denigrating alternative health professions can now be overstated. Wikipedia is, in fact, the virtual face of the apartheid at its worst. But now we should have learned the lessons of how our federal officials handle scientifically proven dangers to the public. Adverse effects of drugs that should have never been approved in the first place, the health risks of agricultural chemicals such as glyphosate, the probable escalation of autism and other neurological disorders by imposing mandatory vaccines upon the population, 5G technology's peril to human health and the environment, the dietary environmental factors associated with our epidemics in obesity and diabetes and autism, heart disease. And of course, there is the evisceration of the consumer protection laws such as Ralph Nader's Clean Water and Clean Air Acts and the erosion of laws protecting our civil rights and freedoms of medical choice. Rarely do we ever read an honest, truthful expose in any major media source about the institutions and organizations that hold power over our lives, such as the dilettantes in the drug and insurance industries, the American Medical Association and other professional medical associations, the CDC, the FDA, the Department of Health and Human Services. All of these entities are the architects and helmsmen of a medical regime that has earned the reputation of being the major threat to health in the nation. In conclusion, the culmination of a medical apartheid brings us to the final step to denounce, ridicule, and shame all alternative medical therapies and their practitioners and their patients. They are called quacks, or in Jimmy Wells' words, lunatic charlatans on Wikipedia, and they risk being banned from Google and Facebook. Consequently, their careers are frozen forever in the virtual reality with no rights to sue or given recourse for removal. And finally, the major thought leaders of non-conventional medicine, as well as their patients who become activists, voices for wellness, such as the countless mothers and fathers of vaccine-injured children, are labeled as a serious danger to public health and should be arrested and put in jail. Hence, they face endless harassment and even arrest and imprisonment. And sadly, this strategy of medical apartheid is succeeding. I'm Gary Nall. Thank you for listening.